Good evening. Tonight's presentation is entitled Freedom versus Slavery. Actually, I was supposed to give this talk last week, as it is the transition between Passover, the exodus from slavery in Egypt, to the standing at Mount Sinai, where we received the instructions from God. So, being that it's a concept, freedom that is, which applies all year round, so even a week later is not so bad. We understand that of all the 613 instructions in the Torah, the one that perhaps is the basis of all of them is the opening line of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, where God, so to speak, introduces himself to the nation for the first time. I am the Lord your God, who took you out of Egypt. Anoichi Hashem Elokecha, asher tziticha me'eretz Mitzrayim. What's interesting here is that the Jewish God, so to speak, is one of experience. The entire nation experiences their Creator. We're the only religion on record that makes the claim that God spoke to an entire people. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, I think it's verses 32 onwards, the claim is actually made by Moses to the Jewish people that there will never be another revelation, and you can check it out, whichever generation you live in, ask yourself, did it ever happen again? Was there ever an event as great as this? Or did you even hear anyone say there was an event as great as this? That God spoke to an entire nation. Every other religion, so to speak, is a private prophecy. And the basis of everyone following that religion is basically faith, belief, but not knowledge, experience, certainty by way of having been first-hand witnesses. But look at the wording. I am the Lord your God, and it doesn't say who created the universe. That would also have been impressive. That's part of his resume. I would have been impressed by that. Why? Who took you out of Egypt? The answer is, one of the answers Ramban gives us, Nachmanides, is that no one was there at creation. So I would have to take that on total faith. But we witnessed the Exodus. We were there. So when God introduces himself as the one who took us out of Egypt, the house of bondage, Mibet Avadim, house of slavery, and we're going to talk about that in a few moments, we understand that what God is saying is, you experienced the miracles, the wonders, the signs, and therefore I'm introducing myself to you as an experiential God. There's two parts to this command. Number one, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, number one. Number two, I took you out of the house of bondage, house of slavery. To understand how far-reaching this message is, appreciate that this is the one time event that has never been appreciated, never been repeated, sorry. And you and I sitting in this room can ask ourselves, after 3,312 years and 6 days, exactly, no one has come along and said it happened to them. Secondly, no other event in our history has so many rituals attached to the event. Every Friday night we bless on the wine before the Kiddush, during Kiddush, and what are the words? We remember going out of Egypt. Every Yom Tov, the same thing. At Kiddush we remember going out of Egypt. Every morning in our prayers, constant references to having come out of Egypt. No end of one example after the other, an entire festival, Passover, dedicated to the time of liberation when we were freed as slaves from Pharaoh. One ritual after the other. Shabbos prayers, reminding ourselves of Egypt. Tefillah, the Shemona Esrei, the one blessing just before we enter that silent prayer with God, Ga'al Yisrael. We remind ourselves in a long paragraph there of all the wonders God did for us in redeeming us from Egypt. The entire mitzvah of tzitzit, the tassels that one wears, is to is that the conclusion at the end of that paragraph, I took you out of Egypt. Even when God says, I'm commanding you to keep kosher, or I'm commanding you not to eat bugs, not to eat insects, He tells us, remember, I took you out of Egypt. When He reminds us to keep honest weights and measures in dealing with integrity in the workplace, again, I took you out of Egypt. Even when He says, take care of the widow and the orphan and the oppressed, because I took you out of Egypt. Something's going on over here. We have to understand what is the big message that God keeps on reminding us. And we have so many rituals that we don't just remember Independence Day of coming out of Egypt once a year on Passover, every single day. The message is resoundingly clear. The Exodus was an event and remains a celebration of freedom and independence. And we have to consider now, what is the definition of freedom, independence, versus slavery? And then understand why it is that this particular event has been stamped on so many rituals on a daily basis. What is it we're not supposed to forget? Imagine a corporate lawyer being accused of being too officious with his wife and children, and that he's behaving like a lawyer out of court when he's in the home. I know it's absurd, but just imagine such a scenario. Or imagine a CFO in a big company. He brings his business home with him, and he really hasn't left the office because he's walking into the house with his cellular phone, already on an important client, and flicking through the newspapers, the correspondence, catching up with voicemail, returning calls. And his wife, his children say, well, Dad, you know, you geographically you are here, but you're really not here. Imagine a slave leaving a labor camp and remaining with a slave mentality, with a slave mindset. What gain is there in the freedom? So what we're about to focus on is how the Jewish people spent 40 years in the desert transforming themselves from slaves to Pharaoh into servants of the Creator. What is freedom? What is slavery? How do we let go? How do I identify that there are areas in my life that I really don't experience freedom, even though we live in a free country? Even though we have freedom of speech, we can vote for whom we want to, but maybe there's a simpler definition of freedom that is so local, touches us so closely, that on a daily basis, is it possible that I'm unaware of how much freedom I lack in simple choices that I'm making when I come home to my family, when I'm at work, when I'm dealing with a coworker, when I'm dealing with my spouse, my children, on a date? Is it possible that part of my personality, thinking, even tonality, even the way I speak or behavior might be a spin-off or a combinational spin-off of many influences, in which case I have to ask myself, how free am I in this choice, in this act, in what I'm saying now, in what I'm thinking now, in how I interpret other people, how I deal with difficult people? How much of it is me deciding, having educated myself as to the options and chosen this as the correct one? Who did I consult with? As opposed to, is this what I saw at home? Is this part of my cultural upbringing, values, educational system, peer pressure, the corporate world that I am absorbed in? In which case I really have to ask myself, who am I free of so that I'm expressing the real me? Let's take some very simple examples of slavery versus freedom, and then I think we're going to start to see very clearly a definition of freedom which I would even guess, and I'm going to tell you up front, is possibly 180 degrees in the other direction when we think about the freedom that the world around us has established as factual. That real freedom is doing what we want, with whom we want, as much as we want, any which way we want, as many times as we want, whenever we want. And that surely appears to be ultimate freedom. But let's look at a few practical examples and ask ourselves, does it really bear out to be true in reality? When we put it under the microscope and ask ourselves, is this the definition of freedom that I can honestly say I experience freedom in this particular item? Let's look at a few examples. I'll give you an example. Making money beyond one's means. Making money beyond one's means. We're living in a society where, and I'm not putting down money, we invented it. We're living in a society where the media has sold on us that success is associated to corporate positions, salary, commission, lifestyle, the car we drive. Is it possible that when we look at someone who's worth X millions, whatever it is, that there's a little voice inside of me that says, if I had what they have, not that I would take away what they have, but if I had what they also have, if I could also have that, I would experience so much more freedom in my life to do what I really want to do. Paul Getty, in his old age, was once interviewed and asked, you have enough billions of dollars to retire all your unborn grandchildren before they're even born. Why are you still working? How much money, how much more do you need? And his answer was, a little bit more. We know that there's no goal to be the richest man in the graveyard. But at which point do we understand that money is working for us to support the quality of life we choose, as opposed to us working for money and more of it and more of it to support a lifestyle that when I have got what I want from the money that I have earned, is it possible that I then see that there is more to have? And then earning money becomes a more serious need, perhaps even more intense, in order to facilitate my receiving the next level in lifestyle, apartment, home, second home, car, model, whatever it is. Is it possible that the money becomes my master and that I become its servant? I never forget, there was once a story told by Rabbi Abraham Twersky, Dr. Twersky, where he had a patient who was sent to him by his parents. And they said, you know, he has an obsession with pancakes. So he was talking to the man for about half an hour, maybe 40 minutes into the session, found him very intelligent, very interesting. And, you know, at this point he said, you know, tell me, why is it exactly that you're here? I know your parents sent you, but, you know, I'm having a very satisfying conversation with you. It's intelligent, it's mature, it's adult. You know, what is the concern? So he says, well, to tell you the truth, doctor, my parents have sent me here because I love pancakes. So Dr. Twersky says, well, so do I. You do? Yeah, sure. Hey, doctor, I've got them in my cupboard, I've got them in the basement, I've got them everywhere, I've got them on my mattress. Come to my house, we'll have a party. Oh, I see. There's nothing wrong with loving pancakes. It's the question of who's in control of who. Here, the pancake starts off as something delicious, perhaps nutritional, one can argue that. And then it becomes a point where my life is taken over by chocolate, or this food, or this drink, or this smoking habit. And suddenly, Who is in control of my life? Who is holding the steering wheel? Who decides my next move? Something outside of me or me? If it's something outside of me, I'm in Egypt. And even if I'm not geographically in Egypt, I took Egypt out with me. Even if I'm not in prison geographically, but if I'm taking it out with me, I'm not free. So let's ask ourselves as we go through different examples, what is the real definition of true freedom? A person is trying to kick the habit of smoking. And I know someone who told me, Rabbi, it's easy to stop smoking. I've done it thousands of times. Never mind. I've stopped smoking thousands of times. Smoking can be something that the body becomes addicted to, and then it becomes an internal craving, and it's no longer me deciding. It's no longer just being wired up into my nervous system. My body is craving for another dose of nicotine. Even as I wean myself off coffee, is it possible that the caffeine in the bloodstream, which takes about 2 weeks of no caffeine till it's completely out of the system, for me to be able to say I'm free of caffeine, is it possible that it's not me who wants the coffee, and that I'm artificially keeping myself awake and not listening to the integrity of my body that says, you're tired, you're overworked, you're over-exasperated, you've gone beyond, take a nap. Well, I really don't have time right now, but I've got a big project ahead of me. Just one more cup of coffee, and that will see me through the night, and I'll have the project ready for 9 a.m. for my boss. And then I'll start the day with a couple of coffees, maybe take a rest and lunch break. And what am I really doing? Who's controlling me? My body is my ally. My body is my home. My body is on my side, telling me when to eat because I'm hungry, drink because I'm thirsty, rest because I'm tired, and relieve myself because I need to. And if I consistently don't listen to my body, is it possible that I have allowed a situation that outside factors control my decisions with my best friend, my body, who's there to support me and give me the most energy possible so that I can be there for myself and for others? We know that eating can take over a person to the point that it's only another second helping. And what's strange about this is that I can be eating food, and when I'm asking myself, shall I take another helping? Is this necessarily the right time to ask the question? Or do I have to wait another 10, 15, 20 minutes for the food to be properly digested? Because if I'm going to make the decision now, is it possible that I'm actually full without realizing it? Because the food hasn't really reached the initial digestive stage. So who's controlling who when I say, well, I'm not full, so I really have room for another helping. And it's the same with drinking, same with drugs, same with spending money. We're in a situation today where part of the education of the media is to impress upon me that more is better. To impress on me that immediate gratification equals happiness, pleasure, fulfillment, success, freedom. And think about it. How many ads, how many still photos on buses and magazines, on the radio, on television and in movies, where movie stars are manipulated to be associated with a product in a still photo or an info commercial? How many times we're being thrown the message, this person in their lifestyle enjoys incredible freedom to go where they want, buy what they want, afford what they want, do what they want. And when that message is associated to the product that they're selling to us an emotional expectation that by living this way, eating this way, drinking this way, dieting this way, driving this way, drinking this way, smoking this way, vacating this way, pretty much covered the whole advertising gamut there, I will experience the same pleasure, freedom, that the person on screen is famous, recognized, admired for. And yet, we are not so shallow, and we don't require PhDs to read the front pages of newspapers to see that many of these personalities in real life are very much out of control, not enjoying freedom in their relationships, saddled with their third spouse, moving on to the next marriage, no satisfaction in the relationship with their children, many times in and out of rehab for various addictions. And so we ask ourselves, is there a correlation? Is there an honest, true correlation between lifestyle and internal freedom? Or is it possible that if there is a correlation, the correlation is between lifestyle and being out of control? Being less in touch with who I am, who my needs are, even as simple as a bodily function, even as simple as budgeting within my earning power, so that I can basically calculate pretty closely what I earn on a monthly basis, figure out quite closely what my expenses are, rent, mortgage, utilities, tax, parking, tolls, etc., whatever it is, tuition, groceries, you add it all up and make the calculation, am I living within my means? And if I'm not, and if I've been doing that consistently, and I have been buying items, not which are absolutely needed, but are a little bit extra here and there on my credit card, because as long as I pay the minimum payment at the end of the month, I can afford this. Can I truly afford this? Who is controlling my life? Me or the credit card and its credit line? Me or my desire for things that I don't have sufficient funds now, only to wake up 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line to discover that had I put away the same amount of money that I spent on items which were not needed and invested that in me, an IRA, a pension plan, or mutual funds, low risk, is it possible that I could be benefiting from the money that is now making interest, working for me, supporting me in being able to not only afford what I've got, which is coming from regular income, but now that I've got outside income from other sources, from investment, that money is now enabling me to afford a higher lifestyle. So it's not artificial, it's real. And that's real freedom, because I'm in control of my finances. Is there any food that tastes as good as Slim does? Is there any food that tastes as good as Slim? Is there any financial security that tastes as good as living within one's means and saying no to that item so that I can say yes tomorrow for something of greater value? My need for recognition, approval from others. Who am I living for? Am I really free in my decisions, the way I dress or act at work, if the person I need to impress is a superior or my boss or someone I'm hoping to get promotion, higher commission and salary? Is this freedom? Am I making choices out of free will? Or am I compelled, either on a conscious or subconscious level, to live, maybe even dine, maybe even dress, nod my head to things and people that I don't really want to, but feel I have to because I will gain their approval. And in doing so, I'm acting the part and not living me. And again, we have to ask ourselves, so what is the real definition for freedom? The third definition for freedom, which we can see very clearly, is being in control of one's life. Being able to say no, even to something we want to say yes to, but saying no is training myself to be in control of me. Being in control is freedom. Being out of control is slavery of one sort or another. Whether money is my master, whether it's the corporate position that I'm shooting for that becomes the obsession, whether it's food that controls my appetite, whether it's drink that controls my desire to find security. We know that when we say no to an extra helping, no to that extra drink, that cookie, no to the cigarette, when we say no to things that we know lead one to another, we experience strength. We experience the inner strength of having said, I control my body, what goes in, what goes out. When we turn off the radio in order to turn on to something which is going to be quality information, when we turn over the pages of a magazine in order to open up a book that's going to give us real clarity, that is self-control. That is freedom. It may not be popular, and it may not be what I want to do on a sensual level. I prefer to flick through the stations till I find something that grabs my fancy and isn't too many minutes into the movie that I can figure out where it is. I may fancy, I may be tickled, I may be compelled, but true freedom is not to do what I want as much as I want, whenever I want, with whom I want, whichever which way I want. Real freedom is to say, I am in control, and therefore I say yes when it's appropriate, and I say no when it's appropriate. Maybe I'll take an extra helping of chocolate pudding on Friday night because it's Shabbos and I want to have a little bit extra pleasure. But the rest of the week, I'm going to be careful to distance myself from alcohol, wine, ta'anugim, pleasures which ordinarily do not support my health. The freedom that comes when we say yes to our child who needs time, attention, and help with school or just wants to unwind, saying yes to that child and saying no to earning another buck, saying no to sitting in front of NASDAQ for another 5 minutes in order to answer the call to one's greatest investment, our children, our family, and we answer that call and say, how's my greatest asset doing? Growing? Wonderful. Let's hear about it. Now, it might not be appropriate 5 minutes to four in the afternoon when we're closing on Wall Street, so we'll make time at another time. But the principle is still there. Who controls me? My portfolio or my total portfolio? Total portfolio, I have to include all my assets, my health, all my assets, my spiritual growth. How much room is there in my life to learn, study, pray, meditate, do a kindness, say I love you, write a letter of gratitude, appreciation? Who is in control of my life? This is the question. It's all very well to leave Egypt, freedom, to be liberated from the camps, but if I take it with me, I'm only geographically liberated. It's interesting that when we were in Egypt, what was the name of the Egyptian despot, dictator, that ruled over us? Pharaoh. In Hebrew, how do you say Pharaoh? Paro. Paro is the letters Pei, Resh, Ayin, Hey. Esoterically, Hasidic works tell us that there is a Pharaoh in every person. The same letters, Peh, Ra. Bad mouth. There's a negative voice. That's what a para is. There's a negative voice inside every one of us that says, I'm undeserving. Don't bother anyway. You're not worthy. Don't try. You're probably going to fail. Give up. It's secure and safe. At least you can't make a mistake. Don't keep trying. It's not going to work. You'll never become anything. It's not worth starting up a business again. Remember the pain you got from that bankruptcy. It's not going to work. And yet we know, according to Harvard report on multimillionaires, I think it was 96% of multimillionaires got that way because they failed the most times in business. And how many times we've made a mistake with our spouse is not as interesting as how well we pick ourselves up and start again and make peace, make amends, learn to get a PhD in apology and let go of the angry nades, dump them and say, I'm sorry, let's start again, and let's communicate without sharp words, without anger. Para, parai, is a dictator, which is a small voice inside of me saying, you cannot, don't try, it's not worth it, you'll never come close to God, don't even start. Para, parai, is a dictator, which is a small voice inside of me saying, you cannot, don't try, it's not worth it, you'll never come close to God, don't even study, you'll never become anything, don't pray, it's not going to amount to anything, you don't have focus anyway. And yet we know that the purpose of living is not to become great in one day. It takes several weeks. It takes several decades. This is a lifetime career in working on. Don't take the para seriously. It's there for me to say, I'm not listening to you. I'm going to become stronger because you're bad-mouthing me, my spouse, my children. I'm not going to listen to your interpretation of everyone that you say is negative. The name for Egypt is Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is spelled Mem, Sadi, Resh, Yud, Mem. It's actually made up of two words. Meitzar, Yam. Yam means ocean, sea. The water is always metaphorical for wisdom, Torah wisdom. Meitzar means a boundary. Mitzrayim, Egypt, is the place that set boundaries on potential. That wants to say, this is as far as you can go, you could never go beyond. It's not true. Those who become the greatest in their areas of expertise, often, when analyzing their childhood and beyond, were the ones that were most disadvantaged in the area they became experts in. Whether it's psychology, children who came from abused homes, whether it's finances, people who lost many times their fortune and started again. Even in a relationship, there's no such thing as failure. There are only, what am I going to do with what I've learned from what I've been through? So Mitzrayim, what we're trying to do is let go of the boundaries that say, I'm limited. I cannot get out of this habit of spending, eating, drinking, believing that I cannot. And para, parai, Pharaoh, the bad-mouthing inside of me, is for me to let go of. I will share with you several examples of where we experience ultimate freedom. When we take total responsibility, im ein ani Li, if I'm not for me, if I'm not there for me, Neely, who's going to be there for me? This is the great Hillel. And this is the basis of love one's neighbor as oneself. Love your neighbor as yourself, Leviticus 19:18. Love others like you love yourself. But what happens if I hate myself? How much do I have to love you? And what happens if I'm suicidal? Now how much do I have to love you? So it can't mean love your neighbor as yourself. What happens if you don't love yourself? So what's the underlying command? What do I have to do before I can really love another person? I have to be in touch with kamecha, loving myself first. Im ein ani li, if I'm not for me, merely, no one else is going to look out for me like I have to. So the ultimate freedom is taking total responsibility for my happiness. And if I blame you for my unhappiness, not you personally, but if I blame you for my unhappiness, you have to change, not me. If you're responsible for making me happy, how much effort do I have to invest in my own happiness? I have to be the one who takes total responsibility for my health. And as much as I want to blame you for stuffing me and always buying me my favorite chocolates, which is very nice of you, of course you're caring, and it's your way of endearing yourself to me, but hell, look at the weight I'm putting in the calories, I can't take it anymore. Do me a favor, don't buy me my favorite chocolates, I can't take it anymore. But if I'm blaming you and making you responsible for the extra flab, I don't have to take responsibility. You have to stop supplying the chocolate. No, I have to say no. And the best time to say no is when it's in front of me, not when the store is closed. I have to take total responsibility for my finances. That means spending less than we earn and investing the difference in ourselves first. And the spillover will be what we can contribute to others too. And that's freedom. Being in control of finances, health, happiness is freedom. Anger, when I make you the one who makes me so mad. You make me so angry when you speak that way, when you remind me about my parents, or you talk about my career, or my health, or whatever it is that I don't like you raising about me, and I blame you for getting me emotionally upset. Who have I made in control of my emotions? Oh, so I have become a servant to you, and I elected to be your slave, dependent upon you. Please be nice to me so that I can be nice back. Oh, so I don't have to take responsibility for being nice to you. You have to be nice to me so I can be nice back. You have to be supportive to me and then I will be sensitive and appreciative to you. No, take total responsibility for being appreciative, loving and grateful, and it's not dependent on the other person's performance. And as long as I make it dependent on their performance, your performance controls my appreciation of you. That's not real appreciation. If my appreciation is for your true virtues, it's independent of your performance. Forgiveness. Real freedom means forgiving. Because as long as I feel deep resentment, anger, bitterness towards this person, even though they don't deserve my forgiveness, it's not about getting them off the hook, it's about me being free of you controlling this resentment in me. And as long as I can't forgive you, every time I see that you are the same, insensitive, unappreciative, unaffectionate, not giving enough to me, and I allow that to be the reason why I will not forgive you, you control me. My unforgiveness of you controls me. That's a choice I have made to be a slave, and you are my master. Forgiveness is not just about forgiving the other person. It's about freeing myself up so that my thoughts and my energy, my health, and even my finances can get the focus it needs to get from me being happy and not bitter. From me being happy and not resentful. From me being happy and not angry. I'm much more likely to take care of my health, my finances, my relationships more efficiently, with more attention, more sensitivity, more love and affection, if I have found a way to be more forgiving. It's not just for your sake, it really is for my sake. And beyond that, we've learned many times, the Zohar tells us in Parshas Emor, when a person is forgiving, they create a forgiveness account. We create an account in heaven of kindness every time we demonstrate kindness. compassion every time we demonstrate compassion. And we make a deposit in that account of forgiveness, compassion, kindness, love, forgiveness, so that if ever we are in need and we've overextended our credit line in heaven, they're allowed to open up that account which I've made deposits in to bail me out of a situation that otherwise I would be undeserving of having that level of compassion, either from others or from God. And so forgiveness is not just about the other guy doesn't deserve it. The ex-wife, ex-husband doesn't deserve it. The answer is let go for my sake, for heaven's sake. It will always boomerang back a great blessing. In relationship with my Creator, taking total responsibility, talking a few minutes a day, reading, learning a few minutes a day. My marriage, take total responsibility to date after the marriage. It's more important than the courtship before, to spend time every week, if we can't do it every day. Time designated, and it's if needed in such a crazy schedule, make appointments, as absurd as it sounds, to go out together. And make sure that it's not only on the calendar, but if I have to cancel, we don't cancel until we have put another appointment down on the calendar. Because if I allow 1 week, 1 month, 2 months, 6 months, a year, 2, 3 years to go by, and we're losing out on spending the time we're supposed to spend together, alone, without the kids, away from family, away from our immediate environment, and we don't do it frequently enough, is it possible that even with good intentions and basically loving spouses, we could erode the relationship so that the intimacy falls away? And our lives start going in separate directions, and we wake up unsatisfied that we're not giving or receiving enough in the marriage. Take total responsibility. Don't hope for a happy marriage. Give up hope of a happy marriage and plan it instead. Give up hope of hoping it's going to work out. Plan it to work out. Totally different. In Hebrew, tikva doesn't mean hope. There's no word in Hebrew for hope. Hope is a very weak translation in the St. James's Bible. It's weak because it suggests, I hope it will happen. I don't have control. I hope it works out. I hope I'll have a relationship with this kid. I hope I'll lose weight. I hope I'm going to be slim for the wedding. I hope I'm going to have a great relationship with my daughter-in-law. I hope that I'm going to be able to retire. I hope I'll have enough money to retire. But if I'm planning to retire, I'm planning a relationship with this kid by taking him out every 2 weeks from school in a lunch break for a pizza, or we go out on Sundays and those are the family trips, so we make time. We're planning for the marriage, for the kids. We're putting money aside. $6 a day! That's not a lot for many of us. But added up, comes to $2,000 a year for an IRA invested prudently, could be $500,000, $750,000, $1 million retirement in a decent mutual fund. That's serious money. And it's all nothing to do with hope. Give up hope of ever retiring and plan it instead. Plan the relationship, plan the marriage, plan the finances, plan the health. Give up hope of losing weight and plan that I'm just going to lose £1 a week, £1 a month. It'll take a while. Follow the directives of Maimonides, who says, eat whatever you want. Just undereat. Exercise every day. And make sure your bowel movement is soft. Guaranteed, you will be healthy. Weight and health are not necessarily correlated. They often are, but not necessarily. Taking control is freedom. Planning is freedom. Not planning is not freedom. It's a cop-out for not taking responsibility for my finances. In my relationship, if I don't invest time and affection and love and forgiveness and intimacy and compassion, and plenty of love notes on the voicemail, email, and personally, I love you because, and fill in the blank, it ain't going to happen. Don't hope, plan. And that's called the freedom of knowing that this relationship is on even keel, it's going in the right direction. In Genesis chapter 2, we are given the description of creation of man. Vayitzer et Adam, and God designed man. But there's an interesting inconsistency in the language. The Torah, which doesn't waste a single letter, puts in an extra yud. Vayitzer is spelt with two yuds. And God designed man.
He created two leanings in us.
Yitzer tov, a positive leaning. Vayitzer hara, a negative leaning. Hashem designed us with both these leanings. And what is the meaning of that? And listen to this beautiful insight from the Zohar. The Zohar on that same page, on that same chapter 2 in Genesis, tells us Yetzer is also language of Yotzer, a designer, an artist, a painter. There are two painters in every human being. There's a good painter and not such a good painter. There's a peh toiv, there's a good mouth inside us, there's a good voice. And there's a pera, there's a pharaoh, there's a bad voice. The good painter pictures beautiful pictures in our mind of what life is about, who people are, what our creator is in our life, what our children are in our life, what our relationships are in our life, my career in my life. There is a good painter in our lives, and there's a bad painter who wants to botch it up and say it's not so good. And we own the choice of which paintings to hang on the walls and corridors of our minds, of our emotions. We paint our reality. We paint the pictures on the walls of our minds. And the good news is, we can take down the ones we don't like and paint over them. We decide the color scheme, the decorations. We make up the image of our inner selves and the outside world around us. And we plan who we become in our finances, in our health, in our relationship with our Creator, with our spouse, with our children, with our parents, by the choices we make. Yetzer means leaning. We can lean in any direction we want. We can change. Explains with Nachman of Breslov a beautiful insight. We have in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, chapter 4, paragraph 1. Ezehu Gibur, who is the powerful one? Hakodesh et Yitzrei, the one who conquers his negative leaning. The one who conquers himself. He can be president of America. But if he can't say no to a simple craving, he has no power internally. Hakodesh et Yitzrei, says Rav Nachman of Breslov, he conquers the bad painter. He tells him, you're not allowed to put that graffiti on the wall. Bad mouthing me like that. Bad mouthing my friends, my spouse, my creator. No way. And he tears it down. He paints over it. He conquers the bad painter, the bad artist, the bad designer, the bad decorator that is trying to tell me, Pharaoh, pull me down. Pharaoh's most powerful and efficient method of conquering the Jews in slavery in Egypt was what method? He kept us busy, constantly busy. No time to think, rest, or consider redemption. And when Moses first came in chapter 6 and announced that we were going to be redeemed and went to Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go," what was Pharaoh's first reaction? This was chapter 5 in Exodus. What? Nirpimatem! You lazy bums! You have time to think about redemption? Right. From now on, we don't supply the straw that helps you make the bricks. You go out and get the straw. I see you have too much time on your hands. From now on, we double the quota. And if you don't keep up the quota, we'll take your little children alive and cement them into the walls. Better be sure you're working hard. Pharaoh's entire methodology was keep them busy. I'll tell you something interesting. In the archives in Washington, there are a name of two Jewish intellectuals, professors who were actually Talmudists, not religious, who were the right-hand men of Hitler in his designing the final solution. They were known as Hitler's Jews. And he had them, on his request, study in detail servitude in Egypt under Pharaoh, so that he would know the strategies to enslave the Jewish people for his needs and uses. And many times you will read accounts that inmates in the camps were so weak from being overworked that they were sparing with the words they chose to speak because of the energy it took to talk. Absolutely true. That's how weak they were, right down to the bone. Pharaoh, it's all very well to talk about him as a historical person, but we're talking about the Pharaoh inside of me, with my beeper, my cellular, my fax machine, and my voicemail, and my email, and between them all, who cannot get hold of me? Who has no access to me? And you put it all together, the more we have, the less we are. I never forget, I had a Rosh Yeshiva, head of Yeshiva in Dvar Yishalayim, Rabbi Horowitz. He used to say, we're in a generation of specialization, that we learn more and more about less and less, until we know everything about nothing. And we own more and more till we are less and less, and I don't know who I am anymore. Freedom, taking control, means letting go of the excuses that I listen to from the negative artist, the negative painter in me, and attaching myself to the beautiful artist in me that describes reality, even when I don't know that it's real, but just saying, Gamzu L'Tayva, this is good, God is behind this, there is ultimate meaning, even when I can't see it, is practicing and training ourselves in reality. Keeping kosher is freedom of controlling what goes in our digestive system. Not saying slander and lashon hara, bad mouthing other people, is controlling what comes out our mouths. We are practicing in freedom of speech. That's true freedom of speech, to know what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say. Freedom is taking control of our finances, putting aside 10% for charity, paying our bills on time, paying our employees appropriately and on time, showing the appreciation. Freedom in Shabbos is the freedom to say the world does not run me. The world is here for me to run it. I decide when the world stops. The car stops. The beeper stops. The fax stops. The television stops. The telephone stops. The email stops. The computer stops. Work stops. And life begins again. Renewing the intimacy with my Creator. Renewing intimacy with my family. Renewing intimacy with my children. Renewing the marriage with my spouse once a month, on the night of going to the mikveh, is freedom in sexuality, in saying that we choose to be in control, and we say yes to more pleasure tomorrow because we know how to say no to what's forbidden or unnecessary today. The mitzvahs are disciplines which are not there to bind us or limit us. They are there to train us in being unlimited in our inner strength of freedom, of being in control of our lives. In today's generation, we have unbelievable, unmatched opportunities that never existed in Jewish history. Dating hundreds of people over a period of a few years,
and going to bed at night and saying, God, I still love you. Shema Yisrael! Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. You really know what you're doing. I don't know what you're doing, but you know what you're doing. God, this marriage is not easy, but I still love you. Give me the clarity. We're living in a generation where there was never so much information and yet so much pain. So much clarity about the dynamics in relationships. So many books and tapes and therapies and courses and sessions and seminars, and yet so much pain in relationships. So much information and clarity on health, and so much unhealthy, unhappy lifestyles. And we live in a generation that when we say no to the media, the consuming media, when we say no to all the lies and fads of what's been called freedom to do what we want, say what we want, eat what we want, drink what we want, smoke, drive, live, work as much as we want. When we say no and take control, there's no generation that has ever had the opportunity of having to invest so much effort to turn ourselves around, being that we are bombarded from so many angles simultaneously. Pharaoh is alive and well. The Pera, the bad mouthing, is alive and well. Mitzrayim, Meitzayam, limited potential, is alive and well. And when we break through that by making small decisions to control finances, health, relationships, happiness, marriage, anger, our emotions, the little incremental steps we take in changing what we listen to, what we read, what we will say and what we won't say, what will go in our mouths and what will go out of our mouths, that is training ourselves in freedom, and it's no small accomplishment. The Torah tells us how to wake up in the morning, how to go to sleep at night, how to be with our spouse in intimacy, how to go to the bathroom, how to get dressed. It's incredible. These are not rules which limit. These are rules which are disciplines in controlling my life. And that frees me up to be in control and experience the freedom that comes with it. Whether it's with our children, with our spouse, with our finances. In summary, we've defined freedom as being in control and slavery as being out of control. And the number one strategy in reclaiming that freedom is, first of all, just being aware of the thoughts and words in my mouth and the behavior or actions that I take, the addictions that I might have, whether they're emotional addictions, whether they are verbal addictions, how I speak sharp words or my tonality or how harsh I shoot at 60 miles per hour within 2 seconds and I'm already at your throat. How we make an awareness of where I am in my slavery to those addictions is number one in becoming aware of who I want to change from. And number two is know and believe that the power of choice truly turns us around from slavery to freedom. We have the choice to not listen to the Pera, the Pharaoh inside of us, and to paint over the graffiti of the Yetzer, the designer, the painter, as we mentioned in the Zohar. And number three, decide one area at a time, whether it's finances, whether it's learning Torah, whether it's prayer, whether it's going to classes, whether it's finishing a project, that we want to become more consistent in controlling that part of our lives. And number four, don't let go. Don't let go and don't give up. Be consistent in persisting, even if I'm inconsistent in my success. Ultimate success is not just that I didn't fall. No, we'll fall again and again and again. The ultimate success is getting up again and again and again. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Before we take questions, and Rabbi Reddy, you're available for questions. Welcome everyone. Paige, New York, I'm Design. I'm Henry Harris. Good to see everybody tonight. We have a couple great programs coming up that I want to tell everyone about. This coming When is it? Next Friday night. Next Friday night is